Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. There is continuing legal fallout from the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, magnified recently by the Eric Garner case in New York. Both men were killed by police officers and were not indicted. We'll get into it from several angles in today's legal roundtable. Also, perhaps it was inevitable, first the same-sex marriage debate, now same-sex divorce, and Facebook and the First Amendment. I'm Don Marsh. Joining me in studio are attorneys Mark Smith, Associate Vice Chancellor at Washington University and Director of the Career Center there. Bill Freivogel is Professor of Journalism at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Roger Goldman is Professor of Law at St. Louis University and is a national expert on police licensing and license revocation laws. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the grand jury. This is a subject that hasn't gone away since the lack of indictment, both here and in New York. Bill Freivogel, let me start with you. Is somehow the door open for a second grand jury in the Brown and actually the Garner case as well?
Well, in the Brown case, for example, theoretically, yes. I think practically, probably no. I mean, it's not double jeopardy. There wouldn't be any kind of double jeopardy problem because jeopardy doesn't attach at the grand jury level. And in fact, the grand jurors in this particular case were told that if additional evidence arose, or like if a video turned up of what actually happened in Ferguson, that there still could be another grand jury, or there could be charges filed. So there's no jeopardy there wouldn't be any jeopardy having another grand jury. There wouldn't be double jeopardy. There has been a suggestion by some. There was a local law professor, May Quinn, who suggested this would be a possibility. There's been some stories in the sort of liberal online media about this. There's a Missouri statute that says that if a prosecuting attorney is interested, meaning has a conflict of interest, that then a presiding judge in that area could appoint a new prosecutor. This happened back. You might remember there was a Faye Copeland and her husband were charged with were involved in the murders of, I think, migrants who came
several
by their farm.
Yeah.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
And it was thought by the judge thought that the prosecuting attorney who had represented the Copelands earlier had a conflict of interest and displaced him. But everyone I've talked to says, well, you know, Bob McCullough doesn't have that kind of conflict of interest here. You know, people have claimed, well, he's too close to the police because he deals with police all the time. His father was killed. None of those are the kind of conflict of interest that we'd be talking about under that statute. So I think there's a very strong view that statute wouldn't apply. Now, also theoretically, Jay Nixon, as long as there's a state of emergency. It was said before that he would have power to appoint a special prosecutor. He's made very clear he's not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at this from just what's fair, I mean, would it really seem fair to even if it isn't double jeopardy, it would really seem fair for this case to go through yet another long, involved process?
Although a lot of people would like to see a different outcome, and I'm sure would lobby for that exactly to happen.
You know, but this process shouldn't be a process in search of a particular outcome that pleases people. It should be, in search of what's just. And of course, there is at the federal level. There's still the federal criminal grand jury that could still theoretically indict Wilson on violating federal civil rights laws.
And the Brown family could bring a civil lawsuit against. That's what's happened in the O.J. Simpson case. You know, he was not convicted, although that went to trial. But then he was found civilly liable. I mean, I think there are risks associated with a civil case because for both sides, you know, there would be – both sides then get to do discovery. And so it could very well be made public, and that discovery could be pretty broad-ranging. So people may not want to do that.
I think the Nicole Brown Simpson family is still waiting for their first buck from
O.J.
That's
another big difference. Darryl Wilson probably – I mean, I don't know this, but I assume he doesn't have the resources that O.J. Simpson had. And like you said, I didn't really get that either.
I wonder – Roger, let me put this to you. Of course we are less familiar with the Eric Garner case in New York, although – I'm sure all of us have seen the video. I wonder if a second grand jury might be more feasible in that case. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well,
My guess is, again, the same problems would occur. To put it in an even broader context, it is very hard to get indictments in these cases. Harris County, which is Houston, they've had 281 presentations to grand juries and officer-involved shootings and zero indictments returned. There's a variety of reasons why these cases are almost impossible to win. Now, it is true in the O.J. Simpson case that those officers were acquitted in the state trial. That's when the riots occurred. But then there was a federal prosecution and two of those officers were criminally convicted. So to get something back to Bill, there is that possibility. And one other possibility, Ferguson's this department itself is being investigated by a separate branch of the Department of Justice called the Special Litigation Section. And that statute arose after the riots in the Rodney King acquittal cases. So civilly, they can go after the department for such things as better training. There's been a pattern and practice of so it's not over yet.
We're going to talk a little bit more a little later in the program about police use of force. But, Bill, you look like you were getting ready to say something.
I just wonder, you know, Roger, just to clarify one thing Roger said, those initial acquittals of the police and then later convictions were in the Rodney King case, not the O.J. Simpson case.
Got it. Sorry.
What about the grand jury process itself? I think we've all read articles recently where people are saying we ought to really abandon this system, that it's essentially not fair. Do you have thoughts on that, Mark?
And I think there was an op-ed in the Post about that. And when you look at it, my understanding is part of the reason it was adopted in the United States was because the government represented the English for the most part. And so the people who were inciting, you know, getting ready to revolt, they wanted to have something in between. So some prosecutor couldn't just come after somebody for trumped up reasons. And so you had to convince the citizen group to go forward. I mean, I don't know. I didn't do enough criminal law to be involved with it to really know that much. But it seems like it's worked most of the time. I think the issue in these police cases is kind of what, going back to what Bill said and what Roger said, actually, is the part of it is the laws that we set up to provide police officers with special protections. Some people may not like that, but that's what the law is right now. And so oftentimes, if people want a particular result, we still have the rule of law and you have to follow those what the law says.
Roger, abandon the system?
Well, let me give you a historical perspective. My understanding is, and I haven't done the research, but I just heard this, was that Missouri, just like the federal government and the Fifth Amendment, did require grand juries in every case. And then the Constitution was amended sometime in the early 1900s to allow prosecutors to go either by grand jury or by filing information in open court. I want to say one thing in favor of grand juries. There are certain times where you would not want to have what's called a preliminary hearing in front of a judge in public. And that is where a particular witness might be. Let's take a child sexual misconduct case. Do you really want a 10-year-old to have to be subject to cross-examination and testify? Maybe in police-involved shootings, that's a different situation. But to throw out grand juries entirely, which, by the way, you could not do at the federal level. It's constitutionally required. But it is not constitutionally required and imposed on the states.
You mentioned constitutional amendments here in Missouri. Just a side note, we see today on our website at stlpublicradio.org that an effort is underway to make it a lot more difficult to pass and approve constitutional amendments in Missouri. What is it, Bill? We have three times as much verbiage in our Constitution as the federal Constitution.
Yeah. And Mike Wolf, at St. Louis University has criticized this recently. And I think, right now, it just takes 50% of the voters to change the Constitution, and that's just a really low hurdle and results in all of these amendments being added. So I think this proposal is 60%, which sounds like maybe a good idea.
Back to the initial question, though, before we digress too far, with regard to changing the grand jury system, what do you think?
Well, the funny thing about it is that some of these criticisms, I mean, they're based upon the way grand juries usually work in a typical case, which is, you just have the police officer comes in, says what he's found in his investigation or she's found in her investigation, and the grand jury indicts very quickly, in just a very short period of time. And so, it's criticized, the grand jury is criticized for being just too much of a rubber stamp for the prosecutor. Well, you can't really use the Wilson grand jury as being an example of that because it was quite the opposite. You know, there was all sorts of there were two months of testimony, and Wilson himself testified to the grand jury. So the thing that some of these civil libertarians like Ira Glasser and Norman Siegel of the ACLU and New York Civil Liberties Union, their complaints about grand juries really are not born. They can't really use very effectively, I don't think, the Wilson grand jury as an example.
You have written about this. Another aspect of the grand jury story in the Brown case is the fact that the prosecutors during this process were saying, ignore parts of Missouri law when you're making your decision here. That seems like a most unusual thing to say, lawyers talking to jurors.
Yeah, well, it was unusual, and Roger and I spent a lot of time trying to decipher this situation. Missouri has this law that basically, to oversimplify, says that a police officer can use excessive force against a fleeing felon who is unarmed. And you could argue, well, you know, maybe Brown was a fleeing felon who was unarmed. So Missouri, that's what Missouri law says. But then several decades ago, the Supreme Court said in a case called Tennessee versus Garner, they said that you can't use if a police officer uses deadly force against a non-dangerous unarmed fleeing felon, that's a violation of the Fourth Amendment. It's an illegal seizure. So there was this tension between the U.S. Supreme Court decision and what the Missouri law said. And in the early part of the grand jury, of the Wilson grand jury, the prosecutors had given to the grand jurors what the Missouri law said. And then after they saw that, well, that Missouri law conflicted not only with the U.S. Supreme Court but also with a revision that was made in some Missouri jury instructions by the Missouri Supreme Court, they said to the grand jury, hey, you know, that those instructions we gave you before that basically would have permitted Wilson to shoot an unarmed Brown who was fleeing from a felony, that those instructions we gave you, ignore those. As a matter of fact, they told him to fold over a piece of paper, abide by what the Supreme Court says, you can't shoot a non-dangerous fleeing felon.
But Roger, had he been indicted, the Missouri law certainly would have come up in trial, and I'd have to assume that therefore Officer Wilson, had he been tried, would never have been convicted.
Well, the question then, Don, would be, would the Missouri approved instructions countermand, in effect overrule the fleeing felon statute that Bill mentions? It's a knotty and ridiculous situation. The obvious solution is that the legislature, which, by the way, just reaffirmed most recently in its amendment to the criminal code, this very obviously unconstitutional situation. So to me, that's one of the easy reforms that nobody can object to, especially police officers, because if a police officer is told you may use deadly force in a situation that's clearly unconstitutional, well, maybe that's a defense in a state case, but you could be prosecuted easily in federal court. So for the police officer's sake, for the suspect's sake, we absolutely have to repeal that law.
And what are the chances of that? I wonder, Mark, you've had life.
Yeah, well, I think people are talking about changing the law, so I think there's a good chance. But I thought there was a difference, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong, but that Tennessee versus Garner clearly applied to civil lawsuits, right? But there was a question about whether it applied to a criminal. Mm-hmm. So there's this idea floating around that, well, the Missouri statute would not work as a defense to a civil lawsuit, but in this case where there's criminal charges, it might be a defense.
No, I think that's right, because as you say, Tennessee versus Garner was a civil case, and not all unconstitutional police behavior is criminal.
Right.
So just because a police officer violates Tennessee versus Garner doesn't mean he's committed a crime.
One other thing. It seems to me if he did intentionally violate Brown's Fourth Amendment rights, that would be a violation of federal criminal law that said you may not intentionally violate a suspect's civil rights.
Well, there's a little more to discuss here, and we'll do that when we come back. We have to take this first break. We'll do that now. This is Legal Roundtable Day. Our guests in studio are Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Roger Goldman. Back to continue this conversation, and we'll hear from you, I'm sure, on this and other subjects as we continue. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with Mark Smith, Roger Goldman, and Bill Freivogel in just a moment. But first, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Governor Jay Nixon is planning to tour the nooks and crannies of the Missouri Capitol this afternoon to get a firsthand look at repairs that could be financed through a bonding plan. The governor has invited legislators to join him. Governor Nixon has spent the past couple of weeks traveling to state universities to highlight repairs and renovations that could be financed with bonds. The Ferguson Commission holds its third meeting tonight. The commission was appointed by Governor Nixon to address concerns raised by the fatal shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown by former Ferguson police officer Darren Wilson. And St. Louis Mayor Francis Slay has announced that his deputy chief of staff, Eddie Roth, will take over as director of the Department of Human Services. Roth, who has been part of Slay's administration since 2011, replaces the retiring Bill Seedhoff. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Okay, before we leave the subject of Michael Brown and the grand jury, let's take a call or two on this subject, then we'll move on. Jerry O'Fallon, you're up first. Go ahead.
Good morning. First of all, a question for you, Mr. Freivogel. I grew up actually in the neighborhood that was the backdrop to most of this activity, and it's not a very common name. There's a family a couple blocks over. Just wondered if you were related.
Most Freivogels turn out to be related because it's a pretty unusual name, and I think we all come from sort of the Muscogee Freivogels in Illinois. But I don't know if I'm related to that particular person.
Okay. Anyway, that said, I still don't understand. I just do not see a downside to Robert McCullough. If he had recused himself, I think it would have added to his credibility. It may not have changed the outcome at all. To me, that's one of those decisions that there's a lot of upsides. There's not a lot of downsides. And I just, obviously, it's fait accompli. It's happened. But I would wonder what your perspective would be on that. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry.
Well, I guess I tend to agree that that McCullough would have been making a good decision had he stepped aside. Having said that, I think I can understand his feeling that he's the elected prosecuting attorney. I mean, the people have had their chance to vote him out, and they have instead reelected him again and again with overwhelming margins. And he's the elected prosecuting attorney, and he was just going to do the best job that he could. Overall, I think he did. I personally think he did quite a good job by bringing in all the evidence to the grand jury. I thought he explained the grand jury's decision pretty well. And it was really quite extraordinary that he released all of this information from the grand jury. I mean, normally a grand jury process is secret. And he released all of thousands of pages of transcripts. So I think there's something to be said on behalf of the way he handled the grand jury.
Roger, Mark, thoughts?
Well, one thought would be is if he did recuse himself in this case, I would assume then he'd recuse himself in every single other police-involved shooting, which may or may not be a good idea. And in terms of the release of the grand jury tapes, transcripts, folks in the Eric Garner case are saying, well, do what Prosecutor McCullough did. But a final worrisome part about that is if you are going to be releasing transcripts of what people say, I'd be worried about what that would do to future potential folks testifying. Would it be in every grand jury case? Furthermore, it could identify someone who testified in a way that might be contrary to what people in his neighborhood might have liked. So it is a little worrisome, although, again, for transparency's sake, you know, it's to be applauded.
I think in hindsight, it becomes clear, like Bill, that it would have been nice. But like, I think Roger raised something that I hadn't thought about. If he did do that, I mean, does that mean everyone in the future can say, well, you've already admitted you have a bias, so you can't prosecute these other cases. We have to have a special prosecutor. The other thing I would say is, you know, he's a prosecutor, so people think his job is to prosecute. And it is, but under the ethical rules, he has a duty to only prosecute cases that he believes are, or where there's probable cause. And I just think back, it was like 5 or 6 years ago, I gave a quote to a Post reporter about some case and basically said, yeah, you know, prosecutor can prosecute any case they want. And then the next time I saw Jennifer Joyce, she kind of got on my case about it, rightfully so, because the ethical rules say that, no, a prosecutor can't prosecute every case. They have to they in fact, have an ethical duty not to prosecute if they think there's not probable cause. So it's not like just they're wind-up toys and you move them forward. They have to exercise their judgment and be bound by this code of ethics.
We have a tweet here from Martin, asks, could McCullough be impeached or recalled? Anyone know?
Well, anyone. I mean, is it possible? Yeah, but I don't see it happening.
I don't know. Do we have I don't think we have recall in Missouri. And
I don't think so.
I don't know. Can you impeach a prosecutor?
I think there was an effort going on right now to recall him. What? Maybe I'm making that up.
I'm not aware of it, but it certainly could be. But
we'll have to do some research on that.
Yeah. I'll take one more quick call on this subject, then we'll move along. Bill is going to join us, I believe, is our old friend Bill Haas. Go ahead, Bill.
Good morning. I appreciated the discussion. McCullough's office did a terrible job. They obfuscated the law. They cross-examined some witnesses and not others, and he should have recused himself, but that's not why I'm calling. Everybody talks about Michael Brown being a fleeing felon, and he hadn't been convicted of a felony. There was the convenience store cigarillo thing with where he pushed the clerk, and the facts of what happened in the car are very unclear. So I was wondering if you guys could address what the standard is for pursuing a fleeing person who may have committed a felony, and whether it's reasonable cause to believe that a felony was committed. Because between the convenience store and the car, there's no clear felony there, to my opinion.
Bill, thanks for the call. Let me just point out, I think that had he been charged, it would have been a second-degree felony for the convenience store situation. But that's
I think that's right. And certainly most of the evidence relating to the car points to a struggle with a police officer, possibly over the gun, and that, you know, also could involve a felony. I'm not exactly sure whether it'd be, you know, I guess the police officer would have to have probable cause to believe that he had committed a felony, or could it be reasonable suspicion?
Roger,
when you look at the Supreme Court decision, the Tennessee and Garner and later cases, they seem to be in favor of the police giving the benefit of the doubt, because it's, you know, the heat of the moment and he's kind of struggling. So, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I think the benefit would go to the officer. And remember, you've got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that, you know, he violated Brown's rights, and that's not easy.
Right. You know, one other thing on this fleeing felon issue, something that Peter Joy has pointed out when he was on this program a month ago, was that, I mean, to a certain extent, to be talking about the fleeing felon thing is a little bit misleading, because at some point he stopped fleeing. He turned around. We don't know exactly what happened after he turned around, whether he walked forward, charged, just stood there. You know, he moved some 20 feet, we know. So to a certain extent, at some point he no longer became a fleeing felon.
Let's move along to the police use of force issue then I want to get back to something else. But while we're here in our discussion, Roger, I'll turn to you. What would you see as likely changes in police procedure policy as a result of what went on in Ferguson? Does anything jump out at you?
Well, a couple of things. We alluded to one in the first place, that this Missouri statute ought to be cleared up to make sure that it conforms to obvious Supreme Court law. Secondly, in terms of reform, I think we have to do a better job on the training, continuing education, which is mandated 48 hours every 3 years for police. Also, I think we need to do a better job on the screening that individual police departments do as well.
Screening of prospective officers,
correct.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, while we're here, can Officer Wilson be precluded from having a police job in the state of Missouri henceforth?
Okay. That's a great question. Missouri is one of 44 states that does have a procedure for license revocation. That's what it's called in this state, decertification in other states. And the statutory language in Missouri is fairly broad. It doesn't require conviction of a crime. You have to have a commission of a crime. So we're now back to what we've been talking about is did Wilson commit a crime? You got the difference between conviction and commission. The fact that there was no grand jury does not bar the state licensing agency. It's called Department of Public Safety and Peace Officer Standards and Training Commission under that. And then there's also another part that talks about denying an act involving moral turpitude. So yes, in theory, in fact, I don't know. By the way, the head of Department of Public Service is Dan Isom.
Right, former police chief in the city of St. Louis, former criminology professor at the University of Missouri-St. Louis.
I think you'd have to guess that it would be unlikely for them to take that action. You know, if a grand jury has decided not to indict, for them to then still come to the conclusion that there was the commission of a crime. I mean, it's not impossible, but it seems like it stretches.
Yeah. Right. And also, I think, I mean, I agree with Roger. I think these are some of the things that should be done. More resources for police training, everything from, you know, how to de-escalate situations. And they do that. And I think it's different in different departments. That's one of the things that would be nice to see come out of this. We've had all these smaller departments where maybe sometimes the training's not as good as at other places. Maybe relooking at just the use of force generally. Providing resources for things like cameras, and we talked about that's more than just buying the cameras. So these are things that they're going to throw money at police departments, and I think a lot of the protesters are not going to be thrilled about that. That this is the solution. You know, if we're saying as a society, well, this is one of the solutions to the problem, I'm not sure they'll be thrilled about that. I also think this post certification and requiring that. I mean, you get police officers who resign when they're brought up on charges, and I'm not sure that always gets to the post-certification. So you get these people who hop around, and making that maybe some legislation to make that mandatory, so there's more information making to these.
In fairness, we should point out also that a number of things that we've talked about are already beginning to gain a little bit of momentum.
You citizen have the citizen review boards, in the city, right.
Citizen
right.
Review Board fines and fees are being mm-hmm. looked at very, very carefully, and some other things as well. So.
You know, Professor Klinger over at UMSL, the former police officer who is a criminology professor, I thought he said two very sensible things relating both to the Ferguson and to the Cleveland case that –
That's the 12-year-old child,
yeah,
with a fake gun.
Right. And he said that – so, for example, in the Darren Wilson, Michael Brown case, that Wilson, even though he may not have committed a crime, he made a strategic or a tactical mistake by, you know, stopping – when he figures out that he's got the cigarillos apparently, then stopping, pulling his car back, confronting him right there. He should have instead driven on, gotten support. Once he had support, then – they could easily have confronted him, and there wouldn't have been the kind of struggle that, you know, where he was at this disadvantage. Similarly, in Cleveland, where the two police cars pull right up to the kid, you know, instead they should have been some distance away and maybe behind a tree. And so this whole idea of de-escalating, you know, whether or not the cameras on officers is going to be the panacea, I don't know, because, you know, the officer himself or herself will be very involved in a struggle. I mean, can you imagine what that – it's not right. going to look like the Eric Garner video. It's going to be a very jumbled video. I talked to an ACLU lawyer in Cincinnati who said he thinks it's much better to have the video on the patrol car than on the officer. Of course, sometimes then you go out of the sight of the patrol car.
Right.
Maybe you need to have both. But the video on the officer is not going to be a panacea.
Well, their technology today is such, I'm sure they could rig it up so that the camera could follow the officer just by having some device on his person. Go ahead, Roger.
Don, in the Cleveland case, my recollection is that the officer had an experience. He was not very good at using firearms, and he's either fired or resigned from another department.
Right.
And then the Cleveland folks said they didn't do the check. But I agree. We once it happens, it's very difficult to get these grand jury indictments. We have to focus on the training, making sure we do these background checks. And the federal government has a role as well.
Before we take our next break, something else that I'd like to bring up with regard to police tactics, if you will, and that is federal judge Carol Jackson here has basically issued a temporary restraining order enjoining police from using tear gas. Let me see how I've got it here. Requires police to give adequate warning before deploying tear gas at lawful protests. Now, I understand the courts getting involved in things like racial profiling, Miranda rights, and things of this kind. But to interfere, if I may use that word, it's my word, in police tactics on the street, Roger, I'll go to you once again. It seems to me to be a most unusual order.
Well, of course, here we're out of the range of the Fourth and Fifth Amendments, and we're in the First Amendment area of, you know, judges do have, federal judges especially, have an interest in protecting the First Amendment rights. And you know, but when it comes into crowd control and use of police force and this clash between First Amendment, I don't think we'd want to say that police have a complete, you know, discretion to use whatever they want. So we've got to remember these are free speech and freedom of assembly issues as well.
Any other thoughts from you gentlemen before?
Well, I mean, I was surprised, too, like you were, Don. But, you know, Roger's absolutely right. First Amendment gets all sorts of protection, and properly so. And, you know, it does seem as though her order, her temporary restraining order, is reasonable. You know, he says give the demonstrators warning, make sure that they have a way to get out, you know, egress. Mm-hmm. I mean, it very much addresses some issues we've had in Ferguson. And it is limited to situations where the protesters are peaceful. Yeah. So, you know, if you – I think you could even argue that if the protesters have already – if some people in the crowd have started throwing, you know, throwing Molotov cocktails or rocks, that's no longer necessarily a peaceful protest. I'm not even sure the order applies to that situation.
And I thought her ruling was deferential. I mean, she's protecting the First Amendment right, but she's also saying – she's not saying you have to give 10 minutes warning, 5 minutes. She's saying a reasonable amount of time. I mean, so she's leaving some discretion to the police officers.
All right. Any other thoughts on that before we move on? Well, we'll move on after we take this break. It's our legal roundtable discussion. We'll continue it in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with our attorney guests, Bill Freivogel, Mark Smith, and Roger Goldman. And we'll stay with the Ferguson issue for one more moment or two. And we've already raised the issue, not raised the issue, but discussed and mentioned municipal fines and fees, municipal courts and what they've been doing. And it has been heavily criticized, certainly by the protesters in Ferguson. It was interesting to note today, again, on our website, stlpublicradio.org, despite the outcry for the unfairness charged by the imposition of these fines and fees, that warrant forgiveness programs that are currently in effect are not having much of an impact. People don't seem to be taking advantage of that. A little bit of a surprise given the outcry, Bill.
Yes, it is. I mean, I think that one criticism that I think you would hear from Thomas Harvey and folks who have very much pushed for this kind of municipal court reform is that, well, the amnesty program, the quote-unquote amnesty program in St. Louis County requires $100 buy-in. It's you've got to pay $100 to get this whole thing, you know, your record looked at. And I know that Thomas Harvey thinks that that's not really an amnesty and that that's deterring people from taking that step. Now, Frank Vatterott, you know, who's been also involved in a municipal court judge who has been proposed the amnesty, says, well, you know, it's just that we've got a group of defendants who don't have enough money to pay their fines, and they just hope the whole thing's going to go away. So he thinks that the amnesty program's a fair one. But even in the city where that $100 is not required for buy-in, only a small percentage of those who possibly could take advantage have taken advantage.
I should point out, too, Mark, that in several municipalities in this area, the municipal court, municipal fines and fees are being challenged in seven municipalities here.
Correct.
So that's another indication that this protest has gotten
and,
some
and
legs.
Auditor Tom Schweik has looked at the issue, I think, with some cities saying that a larger percentage of their revenue is coming from these fees. So I think a microscope, and I know Roger's got some data, but a microscope's going to be, you know, focused on these municipalities to see how much of this is trying to control quality of life and how much it's just a revenue generator, which it's not supposed to be.
And by the way, we can at least mention the fact that the Missouri Supreme Court is taking another taking a look at the red light camera situation, which also has a lot of people ticked off and has been accused of being a system used to raise money primarily.
Yeah, I think one thing that is worth noting, I think this is something maybe Roger knows a little bit more about, is in the, you know, we have Eric Schmidt, the state senator from Kirkwood, who has proposed a 10% limit on the amount of money that a municipality can bring in from their fines and fees. I think currently the limit is 30%, and some municipalities have been exceeding that. Mm-hmm. But as it's been pointed out that if you had a 10% cap, that would – there's a lot of municipalities where – which are largely African-American and African-American officials and elected leaders that would be affected. So you've got unintended consequences. Sure.
Yeah. Let me point out that currently 8 of the 90 municipalities are over the 30% limit. But if you cut it down to 10%, 40 municipalities – and unless they can make that up, and, you know, sales tax is not going to work too well in some of these communities, neither are property
taxes. They have to be voted on.
Yeah, and they would go under, assuming that they're – so that is quite – so it would end city services, parks, recreation, you know, people like these communities. So, you know, it is this unintended consequence that I'm assuming once it gets to the legislature, there will be discussion.
Right. But the silver lining could be perhaps this is the impetus to end this balkanization of like the North County, all these little tiny municipalities, and perhaps raise the level of services. The other thing I would say, I looked at Roger's numbers. I need to give a shout out to the city of St. Louis, under 2%. I know people complain about, but it's nice to see that the city's not doing that.
We should also point out that to end the balkanization also requires a vote. And as Roger pointed out, people like being close to their government, and that's the big stumbling block.
But if their government bankrupt, then maybe they're not as excited.
True. Well, it would certainly make for an interesting discussion. We've had it before, and we'll see. Let me move on to the subject of same-sex divorce. I'd mentioned in the intro, I think, that there seems a certain inevitability that once same-sex marriage becomes a part of the picture, that same-sex divorce would as well. And that is an issue here involving a Missouri couple who were married out of state, and that's key because there's still a ban here in Missouri. A couple out of state wants to divorce, and that is the problem. What is the problem? Who would like to explain it to me?
Well, I guess the issue – so this is before the Missouri – has been argued before the Missouri Supreme Court. Right. And so would Missouri some way have to recognize the marriage in order to issue a divorce – you know, a dissolution of the marriage? I think some other states have not have managed to find ways to dissolve same-sex marriages without recognizing them in the first place. It's just another one of these sort of many legal battles that are going on and that may all be – could all be resolved if the U.S. Supreme Court decides to actually definitively rule on same-sex marriage. And I know they've got about – they're going to have about 4 or 5 more cases teed up for them by the time they come together for their January conference. And it's within the realm of possibility that they could, if they agree in January to hear those cases, that they could have a resolution by the end of the Supreme Court term.
And the lawyer representing these two men is argued, one, well, you don't have to recognize same-sex marriage. You can just recognize that other states recognize it and divorce them that way. But he's also saying, but on the other hand, if you want to go ahead and recognize same-sex marriage in Missouri, you know, we can go for the whole enchilada. And the other thing, I had some of my friends saying, well, why can't they go back to Iowa and get divorced if they got married there? And I think Iowa requires before you can get the divorce, you have to be a resident for a year or something. So it would be a big imposition, you know.
Right. Maybe I'm more dense than usual, but in my notes here, I have it noted that this could lead to Missouri joining the same-sex marriage states. And I don't quite see how that could happen. Do you know, Roger?
Well, again, as Mark's suggesting, is a divorce less you know, could you have a situation where we would allow a divorce from another state while still not recognizing marriage? And by the way, those cases are going up to the Missouri Supreme Court as well.
Huh. But, right, but they can go for this big thing and say, while we've handled this issue, we're also going to say that you can't have, that our the Missouri constitutional prohibition on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional, and they could do the whole thing then.
All right. Let's go back to the warrants issue so we can bring Jim from Kirkwood into the discussion before we move on. Jim, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Sure. I just want to discuss I've been in a lot of these municipality courts. I've got a rental property in Maplewood, and there I've seen so many abuses in these municipal courts. I've been a victim of it myself. I got arrested one time for receiving a ticket for high weeds, which I never received, which ended up costing me $600. I brought up to the judge the fact that there was, I didn't receive a ticket, and in their own ordinances, they're supposed to send a certified letter. When I brought that up to him, he banged his gavel and said that would be $486. Huh. And also, isn't there a Missouri statute that the municipalities cannot pass ordinances that are in conflict or enhance a state law?
Thanks, Jim, for the call. I'm not certain about that. Let me see if anyone here is.
Well, I think you've well expressed why these municipal courts sometimes cause a lot of frustration. The Arch City Defenders, Thomas Harvey's group, has put out a report, I think it was earlier this year, in which they very well described the ways in which these municipal court actions can wreck poor people's lives, and some folks who may not be poor certainly end up very very annoyed. I mean, there are all sorts of practices that are problems. They were having closed courts. They were not allowing in. They weren't allowing people to bring their kids in. So then they weren't able to appear for their their traffic violations. The second part of the question, I know that sort of relates a little bit to the red light cameras. I think local ordinances can't be regulating the same thing as a state ordinance and be in conflict. So I think there is something there, but I'm not exactly sure.
The other issue with these courts, and there was this Better Together report that came out within the last 6 months, and they talk about, the fact that a lawyer who acts as a judge in one municipality may be a prosecutor in another municipality, and there's just all this kind of incestual kind of goings-on, and it just – once again, it's – it's great having a small municipality, so you get your people, and it's very close. But then you have these more opportunities for kind of problems to occur, and they're not on the radar screen because they affect so few people.
Mm-hmm. And on one possibility would be to have St. Louis County courts making these decisions, so that you would get rid of all these little courts. But still allow the local police maybe to do the enforcement. Then the question would come up about revenue sharing, but at least it would get rid of the abuse that's being discussed.
Weren't they also talking at one point about bringing in public defenders or pro bono attorneys to deal with these cases?
Yeah, that's another issue, that there's some tension between, say, the Thomas Harveys and the Vaderats of the world, where Harvey thinks you should have a whole public defender system in municipal courts that's paid for by the revenue that the municipalities are raising from the municipal courts. Vaderat takes the position, well, we could have law students or volunteers.
Right. It would slow down that process, I would think, if you had more lengthy hearings on these cases.
Well, on the other hand, it might speed it up, because if you've got a lawyer representing them where they can kind of send an email saying, I got these three cases, can I plead them down to this? You could get it all done and not even have to go to court.
Okay, let's move on to the Supreme Court. A couple of things I want to at least get on the table here. One is the UPS case, which most people are familiar with. It got a lot of attention when it was argued, and that basically involves a UPS employee, pregnant, who was dismissed, I guess, because she could not lift packages over 20 pounds. The court has yet to decide that. But what are the broader implications of this case? Or are there?
Well,
go ahead.
So first of all, I should say the case was argued by a former law school faculty member from WashU, Sam Begistanos, who I think is now Michigan, right? Yeah. But I think they're looking at this law because are we going to give pregnant females the same rights as other employees, whatever the company says those rights are? And in this case, UPS says you can get limited duty basically if you're injured, it's a work-related injury. So if I hurt myself in the backyard digging a trench or something, I don't get special accommodation.
Or if your driver's license has been revoked because of a DUI.
Right. But if I get – my injury is not work-related, and here – you know, the disability is, and it's not an ADA thing, then you don't get it. And the justices were clearly troubled by that, saying, is this really what the law intended? So they may go beyond. When I first read it, I thought this case wouldn't go forward. But now I'm starting to think maybe they'll do a little more expansive reading of the law.
But UPS has already changed its policy.
Right.
Yeah, I wonder what impact that has, if any, on the court in this case. Thoughts, Roger?
Well, usually what you do something in retroactively that's like that will not bind them in the future. But it's kind of like the McCullough question. If he recuses himself once, you know, won't he have to do it forever?
Right.
Thoughts, I mean, I think it shows that regardless of what the law, how the court decision comes down, that this is this kind of that the policy they have now jettisoned is not really one you can defend very well in public. That you're not going to let a pregnant woman have a little bit lighter duty of lifting smaller boxes.
Yeah. Well, I won't say what I'm thinking, but we'll see how the court rules on this. One other thing concerning the Supreme Court, and that is the use of violent language on Facebook. So many people are using Facebook these days, but in this particular case, violent or threatening language was used by a man threatening his wife, and they also cite some rap lyrics that are used on Facebook. This is clearly, Mark, a big First Amendment deal.
He views himself as a rap artist, and he was posting rap lyrics, but they were and this guy wasn't just threatening his wife. He threatened an FBI agent and a kindergarten class, and we were talking about this in my class, and I said, man, you want to get like three people, you know, I'm with you with maybe the wife who hasn't said kind of, but when you start threatening kindergarten kids and workers, co-workers was the other thing. So the question is, he says, I didn't intend it. They say, well, it's a reasonable intent. What would a reasonable person think? And so the Supreme Court is clearly troubled. You've got, I think it was Kagan, trying to come up with some kind of standard in between objective and subjective intent, what you meant and what other people thought, would it be considered reckless? I looked at this stuff. I mean, I think it looks like he's threatening people to me. As a reasonable person, I would think I would be scared if I were the spouse or a parent of one of those kindergarten kids.
How far into the First Amendment can you go?
Yeah, right.
Threatening people.
Yeah, I mean, I think so a true threat is not protected speech.
Right.
So is this a true threat? And, you know, you want to give – because it's a First Amendment issue, you want to give as much leeway as possible. But, isn't a reasonable person standard isn't that the appropriate one? Because you certainly seeing these threats of, you know, next time I'm going to, you know, shoot a kindergarten class and, you know, is a court order thick enough to stop a bullet? And, gee, the FBI agent didn't realize I had a bomb strapped to my chest that I would have detonated. I mean, that would seem like more than just sort of venting.
And they don't rhyme. So that cuts into your whole rap.
We've said many times in this program that much law is yet to be written with regard to what's going on the internet and social media. Just a minute left. I wanted to clarify one thing that has been in the news recently. It's a reference to the hammer slang in the Bosnian community in South St. Louis. And there's talk now that the suspects in that case could be tried as adults. They are juveniles, as I understand it. We only have a minute left. What is the process for making that transition from juvenile to adult? Do we know?
Well, I think there has to be a hearing. As I read the stories, it looks as though one of the persons has already been charged as an adult, the 17-year-old, and the two who were taken into custody who were younger than that, there would have to be a hearing to certify them to be tried as an adult. I don't know exactly what the standards are.
18 is the cutoff date, is it not?
I think
so too, yeah.
Okay, and there was one other issue that came up I meant to clarify, and we moved on to something else. We were talking about a temporary restraining order on the part of the federal judge. What is that? I mean, how temporary is temporary in 15 seconds, Mark?
So you go in for a temporary, and then they say come back in like 30 days, 90 days, and we'll have a larger hearing. Although this hearing was 9 hours long, I heard. Yeah. So it was a big temporary hearing.
So we'll be hearing about this within a relatively short period of time. Got to end it there, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being with us. Bill Freivogel, thank you. Roger Goldman, thank you for being with us once again on short notice. Appreciate that. And Mark Smith, thank you so much for being with us. We'll get together again in about a month, I guess, after the new year. Happy New Year to you.
You too.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the Venture Cafe. It's a unique monthly gathering that encourages collaboration between innovators and entrepreneurs. And we'll talk with tax expert Lance Weiss about what can be done to minimize tax obligations before the end of the year, yet another deadline. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.